It's time for us to begin. If you would please open your Bible to 1 Corinthians 15. We'll just kind of cite that because we've cited it the last 2 weeks at least. But I do want to use that as an introduction to the things that we want to talk about relative to the last week of Jesus' life, particularly concerning the evidences of his resurrection. In our study tonight in 1 Corinthians 15, the whole chapter is dealing with the resurrection. Evidently, some had polluted the thinking of these in Corinth on the subject of the resurrection, among many other things, as we have studied in times gone by. I want to simply read about the first four verses to introduce our thoughts tonight. The writer says, "Now I make known unto you, brethren, the gospel which I preached unto you, which also ye received, wherein also ye stand, by which also ye are saved, if ye hold fast the word which I preached unto you, except ye believed in vain. For I delivered unto you first of all that which also I received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he hath been raised on the third day according to the Scriptures." Now, beginning in verse 5, we see a number of appearances that the apostle records for us. He doesn't record all of them. He's simply establishing that Jesus was raised from the dead and showing then the consequences if he was not raised from the dead, and other thoughts throughout this chapter, some of which we'll include perhaps in the invitation in a little bit. But in our study tonight, we have noted in Mark's account and in John's account the first appearance of Jesus to Mary Magdalene. And Mark tells us that she came to the grave site to bring spices to anoint the body of Jesus. Mark also tells us that the women that were with her expressed their concern that when they got to the tomb, what were they going to do about the tremendous stone that sealed the door to the tomb. And so we find, however, when they arrived, the stone was rolled away, and there were two angels in the tomb. They saw Jesus, and Mary Magdalene in particular thought that he was the gardener and wanted to know what he had done with the body of Jesus. She refers to him as Rabbi, Rabboni. In our study last week, we noted in John chapter 20 and in verse 14 that when she saw him, she knew not that it was Jesus. Now, I don't recall if I had this on this chart last week or if I've added this, but apparently he was manifest in another form when he showed himself to not only Mary Magdalene when she saw him and thought he was the gardener, but also to the disciples and a number of other passages. Now, don't ask me to explain that. I don't know how to explain that he wasn't recognizable. We're going to see the same thing concerning the two disciples that were on their way from or to Emmaus, that they did not recognize him either. Daniel King, in his commentary, makes this point, and I thought it was rather interesting. He said, "Why this is so, we cannot tell, and his desire to speculate too much, but the text only relates to this being the case without explaining." Now, there that is. We don't understand, don't know, because the text just doesn't tell us why she didn't or why the other disciples on these occasions, why Jesus manifested himself in another form. So we'll not try to speculate on that. We left off last time talking about Mary Magdalene and her effort to hold on to him. Now, we did note a little bit from some of these parallel passages that this is not the only occasion, for there were other women who tried to hold him by the ankles. But on this occasion, he said, essentially in the New American Standard Translation, "Stop clinging to me." And we talked a little bit about why that was the case and so forth. We talked about the importance of the resurrection. We did not talk about that Jesus was not leaving immediately. He was going to be among the disciples yet 40 days after his resurrection, teaching them things concerning the kingdom. And of course, they didn't understand all of that either, which is evidenced in Acts chapter 1. But point is, perhaps she was clinging on to him as if he was going to leave immediately. And that was never the intention We note that she was instructed to inform the disciples, and the disciples did not believe her. We saw that in Mark's account. We were talking a little bit about the first day of the week last time, and I don't think there's any reason to speculate beyond that, to note that they were on the Roman calendar, as we see the dawning of the day toward the first day of the week, late on the Sabbath day, if you please, but that would be the equivalent of about sunrise there about on Sunday, on the Lord's Day. So not a great deal of debate on that. As we turn now in our text to Matthew's account, the 28th chapter, read with me, if you will, beginning in verse 9. Matthew, the 28th chapter, beginning in verse 9. The text tells us, "And behold, Jesus met them, saying, All hail. And they came and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then said, saith Jesus unto them, Fear not, go tell my brethren that they depart into Galilee, and there shall they see me." Who were these folks?
Mary and Mary.
Mary and Mary, yeah, simply identified as the women. Of course, Luke's account gives us somewhat more detail on that. They came to Jesus to worship him. The instruction was, go tell the brethren that you'll see me, or go tell the brethren to go, rather, to Galilee. Let's turn over, if you would, please, to Luke's account and read in the 24th chapter of that account, beginning in verse 9. Luke 24, verse 9. You'll note in latter part of verse 5, the question, "Why seek ye the living among the dead? He is not here, but is risen. Remember how he spake unto you when he was yet in Galilee, saying that the Son of Man must be delivered up into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and the third day rise again. And they remembered his words and returned from the tomb and told all these things to the 11 and to all the rest." Now they were Mary Magdalene, Joanna, and Mary, the mother of James, and the other women with them told these things unto the apostles. And these words appeared in their sight as idle talk, and they disbelieved them. But Peter rose up and ran to the tomb, and stooping and looking in, he seeth the linen clothed by themselves, and he departed to his home, wondering at that which was come to pass. So we've got Mary and Mary and a whole bunch of folks, lady folks among those that now are aware that Jesus has been raised from the dead. Now, Mary Magdalene obeyed the Lord's instruction to go and report what she has seen. And as we've noted, the words of these women was not valued as evidence that Jesus indeed had been raised from the dead. I think that this is worthy of just a brief comment. When Jesus said to go tell the brethren to go to Galilee, who was he talking about?
The apostles.
Likely the apostles to go to Galilee. Some have tried to suggest, and I think it's worthy, like I say, just of a brief comment, that he was talking about his fleshly brothers. I don't think that's even a consideration, and I'll tell you why. Because there's no real evidence that his brothers in the flesh believed him to be the Christ, much less at this point raised from the dead. There's no evidence at this point that they've been witness of his resurrection. And in fact, a noteworthy passage is found in John's account in the 7th chapter. If you're familiar with this, and I think most of you are, beginning in verse 4, John the 7th chapter, verse 4, the writer says, "For no man doeth anything in secret, and himself seeketh to be known openly. If thou dost know doest these things, manifest thyself to the world. For even his brethren did not believe on him." Now the setting of this is quite fascinating. The 7th chapter, the stage is set in verses 1 and 2. Jesus has gone from Galilee walking to Judea to observe the Feast of Tabernacles. Now tell me what the Feast of Tabernacles is, and why would he go to the city of Jerusalem to observe that feast? Some translations may refer to it as the Feast of Booths. What was that? Anyone remember? Pardon me?
Is that the one where they were to think back on the time when they were wandering?
Yes, yes. And they lived in booths or tents during the period of wilderness wandering. That's right. And, of course, Jesus was going back to the to Judea to observe this as well. And the thing that's kind of interesting in this setting, in the seventh chapter, I'm sure you remember this from our study of the Gospel of John, that the brothers of Jesus had ridiculed, they didn't believe him to be the Christ, and they're encouraging him to use this occasion to declare himself. And you recall in this chapter, Jesus did go to the city of Jerusalem, but he didn't go with them, and he didn't go in a public way to the city. He went, as we would call it, the back roads, and entered secretly into the city to observe this occasion. But the point that we're establishing here is from verses 4 and 5 that his brothers did not believe him to be the Christ. And they're kind of in a mocking way making fun of him. So there's not really any evidence at all that the fleshly brothers were involved in this until we know the Apostle Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 that he appeared to James, and I think the James identified there as the Lord's brother, and I think he becomes a prominent character of the church in the city of Jerusalem. Evidence of that is in Acts the 15th chapter, where he became a prominent spokesman on behalf of the brethren in Jerusalem. So, any comments or questions at this point? Randy?
I think I made the reference before. Luke, in the Luke account, it mentions Joanna.
Yes.
And Joanna is also found in Luke 8:3 as the wife of Chuza, Herod's steward. Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's steward. It mentions and Susanna and many others who were contributing to the support of the private out of the private means.
Yeah.
So we think we can assume that's who that Joanna is.
It's possible.
Yeah. And then it's Mary, possible. The Mary that's listed there, it says Mary Magdalene, Joanna, and Mary's mother James. That Mary is mentioned also in Matthew 27:56.
Okay.
Where it says Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. So the mother of the sons of Zebedee, I've forgotten where I was going with that. Sons of Zebedee were James and John.
Right.
So there were two Marys, mothers of James. But this one was Mary, the mother of James and Joseph.
Yeah, very common name, evidently, or obviously so. Yeah. So
it still is.
Yeah. One of the difficult things, Randy, as you well know, is trying to identify when you come to a name so commonly used as to which one it is, which, of course, we've got Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Jesus, Mary the mother of the sons of Zebedee, James and John. And, yeah, so that we've got to identify as best we can who we're talking about. All right. Any other comments or questions? This next segment of our study, while you have your Bible open there to Matthew's account, pick up the reading at verse 11, and let's read down through verse 15. I have it on the board trying to emphasize some things, but we'll read it together. Now while they were going, behold, some of the guard came into the city and told unto the chief priest all the things that had come to pass. And when they were assembled with the elders and had taken counsel, they gave much money unto the soldiers, saying, say ye, his disciples came by night and stole him away while he slept. And if this come to the governor's ears, we will persuade him and rid you of care. So they took the money and did as they were taught. And this saying was spread abroad among the Jews and continueth until this day. I said this is quite an impressive passage. Notice, if you will, some of the guard came into the city. Help me to understand a little bit better who the guard was.
It was the temple or the Sanhedrin guard, wasn't it?
Likely. And it tells us that they came and told the chief priest all the things that would come to pass. And that would explain why these of the guard came to the chief priest. Now, there are those who argue and make some arguments about these soldiers being Roman guards. I'm not persuaded that that's the case. And some kind of make a case on that why were Roman soldiers coming to the chief priest, because they would likely have been responsible to Pilate. And that's true. But you remember when the leaders of the Jews came to Pilate about the disciples stealing the body, he said, go away and make it as secure as you can. Who was he talking to? He wasn't talking to Roman soldiers. He was talking to the leaders, the cohorts among the Jews. So it would likely be, at least in my opinion, the Jewish Sanhedrin court soldiers that are now responsible for the grave site, and that would explain why they came and explain things to the chief priest. Now, the thing that I find quite interesting is when they assembled the elders together and had taken counsel, they gave much money to the soldiers, saying, say ye his disciples came by night and stole him while we slept. Now, I've tried to emphasize, while we slept. Do you not see in that the leaders of the Jews are telling the soldiers to lie and to essentially incriminate themselves of a crime that by most standards would require the death penalty? What would happen to a soldier, or, case in point, the Philippian jailer, if somebody escaped on his watch?
Be executed.
Now, were these guys really any different? But the leaders of the Jews are telling these soldiers to confess, we were on guard, but we were asleep. And while we were asleep, his disciples came and stole the body away. All right. Now, if you confess to that, and that's your story, and you're sticking to it, as they say, the death penalty would follow, would it not? But you see, their point is, we're the leaders of the Jews. And if this comes to the ears of the governor, who would that be? That'd be Pilate. Yeah, that's right. And who was it that told you, essentially, told us, to secure the tomb and make it as secure as you could? Who told us that be done? Well, Pilate did. And so, if this comes to the ears of Pilate, we'll persuade him and rid you of care. Now, I tell you what, brethren and dear friends, I certainly would not want to be one of those soldiers depending upon the integrity of these leaders of the Jews for my life, would you?
It says it was a large sum of money. I guess it must have been a pretty large sum of money. Everyone's got their price.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about that? So, yeah, they took the bribe, and they did what they were told. And the interesting thing is, this saying was spread abroad among the Jews and continued unto this day. Now, if you're talking with somebody today about this as evidence of Jesus being the Christ, he was raised from the dead, what argument are you going to hear today? Same one. Go ahead.
I was just thinking, you know, what it says in verse 11, that some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priests all that had happened. And what had happened was up there in the first part of the chapter, a severe earthquake, an angel descended from heaven, rolled away the stone. His appearance was like lightning and his clothing as white as snow. The guards shook for fear because of him and became like dead men. So they saw the earthquake. They saw the stone rolled away. They saw the angel appear like lightning. And then they went and told the chief priest all that. And the chief priest said, tell you what, we'll give you a bunch of money, and you say this instead.
Yeah.
It's the same attitude that they had when Lazarus was raised from the dead. It's like, never mind the miracle.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how we can keep control of this situation.
How we can spin the story?
How we can spin the story and make ourselves look good.
Yeah. Well, politics is about the same, isn't it? As it's always been. And that's what you see in this. So the report of the guard, if you were a guard and you said, we lost our prisoner, he was a dead man, but we lost him while we were asleep, that would not be very good testimony on your behalf. But that's what money talks. And so they're willing to tell the story if you give me enough money. So you're right, Caroline, gave him much money. And Matthew, I think that... as you suggested regarding Lazarus, here you've got one more stab by the leaders of the Jews who are the enemies of the cross, the very ones who plotted Jesus' death. Now they've got to somehow answer the resurrection. So here's one more stab at that, and so they engage in fraud in order to conceal the reality of the resurrection. So, yeah, it was the Roman governor that had set the guard, instructed them to do that, yeah.
And they paid false witnesses at his trial.
They did, yeah. Real honorable fellows, aren't they? Leaders of the Jews, they are, yeah. So here you go. And so that's the report. Money talks. talk. So my question on this, I think is kind of interesting. The role that these fellows had, when you talk about the elders, they sat on Moses' seat. Jesus rebuked them. You remember in Matthew 23, you sit on Moses' seat. And what is it that you do sitting on Moses' seat? Let's look at the text. Matthew 23, verse 1 beginning. Then spake Jesus to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. All things, therefore, whatsoever they bid you, these do and observe, but do not ye after their works, for they say and do not. And they bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with the finger. But all this they do, or all these works they do, to be seen of men. And he begins to elaborate on those things. But now let's look at the hearts of these guys. They're the ones that sit on Moses' seat. They're supposed to make righteous judgments. And here they are offering bribes to the men that are appointed to guard the tomb, saying, go out here and lie. Here's a bunch of money. Go tell a lie.
The way the New American Standard reads in verse 1, that Jesus spoke to the crowds and said to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses.
Yeah.
I don't think that's where they were supposed to be.
Well,
he's saying that they are legislating law.
Well, that part is true.
They had no business in the seat of Moses at all.
Yeah.
They seated themselves there.
Yeah.
Well, you've got... And I think throughout this context of the 23rd chapter, you've got the objects of these woes, the scribes and the Pharisees, essentially the judicial proceedings as a whole Jesus is before on this occasion. Scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. I think it would include the Sanhedrin court, those who were responsible for making judicial decisions. So in a very real sense, yeah, this is supposed to be your legal system. But look at what they're doing. And look at what they did, even to bring about the death of Jesus. They offered money to try to hire witnesses against him.
And the description, like a cup that's washed on the outside but dirty on the inside, or like a crypt full of dead men's bones.
Yeah, you see that in verse 27 and following. Yeah. Yeah, full of dead men's bones. Now, these are the folks that could read the law of Moses, thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor, but they're paying men to lie. And this becomes the lie from that day forward. I find that quite disquieting. So they've instructed these men to lie, and what did the men do? They took the money and did as they were taught, and this saying was spread abroad. So here you are. You lie for this amount, and we'll scot you if you get in trouble. Okay? Any other questions or comments? Well, we've got another appearance to consider. This takes us to Luke's account. Luke, the 24th chapter, if you would turn there with me, please. Luke, the 24th chapter, and specifically verse 34. We might begin the reading beginning at verse 32. And they said one to another, was not our heart burning within us while he spake to us on the way, while he opened unto us the scriptures? And they rose up that very hour and returned to Jerusalem, found the 11 gathered together and them that were with them, saying, the Lord is risen indeed and hath appeared to Simon. And they rehearsed the things that happened in the way and how he was known of them at the, or in the breaking of bread. More on that in just a little bit. But I think what we have when we line this one up by Paul's statement in 1 Corinthians 15 is we've got Simon identified as Cephas. And I'm not suggesting that this was the only time that Peter or Cephas was in the presence of the resurrected Lord. I think that he had that privilege a number of times. But what we see in Luke's account and then specific mention in Paul's account in 1 Corinthians 15 is a special appearance of Jesus before Peter. Any thoughts particularly on that? We've got another appearance of the Lord that's recorded for us, and that's to these two disciples on the way to Emmaus. And we'll use Luke's account, chapter 24. And Randy, if you would, I've got rather lengthy reading here that involves these two men. If you would begin at verse 13 of Luke 24 and read down through the remainder of this text, because there's several things we want to talk about through verse 35, please.
Luke 24:13-35. And behold, two of them were going that very day to a village named Emmaus, which was about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they were talking with each other about all these things which had taken place. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself approached and began traveling with them. But their eyes were prevented from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are these words that you are exchanging with one another as you are walking?" And they stood still, looking sad. One of them, named Cleopas, answered and said to him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem and unaware of the things which have happened here in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" And they said to him, "The things about Jesus the Nazarene, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word in the sight of God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to the sentence of death and crucified him. But we were hoping that it was he who was going to redeem Israel. Indeed, besides all this, it is the third day since these things happened. But also some women among us amazed us when they were at the tomb early in the morning and did not find his body. They came, saying that they had also seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just exactly as the women also had said, but him they did not see. And he said to them, 'O foolish men and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary for the Christ to suffer these things and to enter into his glory?' Then, beginning with Moses and with all the prophets, he explained to them the things concerning himself in all the scriptures. And they approached the village where they were going, and he acted as though he were going farther. But they urged him, saying, 'Stay with us, for it is getting toward evening, and the day is now nearly over.' So he went in to stay with them. When he had reclined at the table with them, he took the bread and blessed it, and breaking it, he began giving it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to one another, 'Were not our hearts burning within us while he was speaking to us on the road, while he was explaining the scriptures to us?' And they got up that very hour and returned to Jerusalem, and found gathered together the 11 and those who were with them, saying, 'The Lord has really risen and has appeared to Simon.' They began to relate their experiences on the road and how he was recognized by them in the breaking of the bread."
And it's a profound text in so many ways. Notice, first of all, that we have one of the disciples named Cleopas. Others have supposed that the one who is with him is Luke. I don't know that there's evidence to support that, but some have suggested that on the basis that it's Luke that's recording this, and he doesn't record his name. So I don't know that that argument has enough merit, at least to persuade me, but be that as it may. But again, we call your attention to the fact that he was manifested in another form and showed himself to these disciples. And we've got similar thoughts expressed in the passages that are on the board. So why did Jesus do that? I don't know. How did Jesus do that? I don't know. The scriptures just don't tell us that. But what it does tell us, and I think the thing that is so incredibly fascinating from this text, is the understanding of these two disciples. First of all, what do they, let me suggest this. They're talking about the things that have just happened. Now, the things that have just happened, keep in mind now that Jesus is raised on the third day. So the events relative to the crucifixion are just, they're fresh. And they're talking about these things. Now, they didn't recognize who Jesus was, much like Mary Magdalene, as we talked about a few moments ago. The evidence of that's in verse 16. Their eyes were holding that they should not know him. Now, don't ask me to explain why they didn't recognize him. The point is just simply established that they didn't. And then in verse 17, he asked them, what are you talking about as you're walking along? And the one named Cleopas said, "Dost thou alone sojourn in Jerusalem and not know the things which come to pass in these days?" I find that question just absolutely amazing. Are you the only one that's been in Jerusalem these last few days and you don't know anything about what's just happened? And he said to them, "What things?" Now, is Jesus playing with them? We might reason that way. I don't believe that he is. He's asking them to explain the incredible things that they no doubt have been witness to. It says, and they said unto him the things concerning Jesus the Nazarene, who was a prophet, mighty indeed, and word before God and all the people. How'd they know that? What's that tell you about these two fellows?
It already says that they were with the disciples.
Yes.
When Mary Magdalene and the others went there.
Okay.
And it says that they now coming back to the same place that they were. And we see then that Jesus is going to appear to them again in just a little bit.
Yes, he is. But what does this tell us about their recognition? He was a prophet. He was mighty indeed in word before God and all the people. What have they seen?
They've seen the preaching and miracles.
Yes, that's what they've been, as you pointed out, they've been among the disciples for a period of time. They've seen a lot of things. And no doubt witness to the crucifixion. It says, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. Now, this is what we know. You've been in Jerusalem all this time, you don't know anything about that? And verse 21, we'd hope that it was he that would redeem Israel. Now, that's an interesting word, redeem. Because the idea is to buy back or to pay for a ransom. And we know that perhaps even among the disciples, the reasoning ran something like this. We're under the thumb of Rome and we want to be out from under the rule of Rome. And we thought that this would be the man that would do that. Now, that's one pretty strong, I think, viewpoint. Another viewpoint is perhaps they understood what the prophets had said. I would highly doubt that to this degree, that even among the apostles, they do not have a real clear concept of the nature of the kingdom in Acts chapter 1. And that's toward the end of the 40 days where he's been teaching them regarding the kingdom. And this is brand new on the third day, right after he's been raised from the dead. Now, you'll note in verse 21, the latter part of that expression, yea, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things came to pass. What does that statement tell us? What do they understand? Several things, as a matter of fact. It's supposed to happen today, yeah. Now, we've seen signs, we've seen miracles, we've heard his teaching, and we know that he has been crucified, and we had hoped that he was the one that would redeem Israel, and this is the third day. We've heard his teachings about what was to take place on the third day. We were expecting something on this day. And then here are some women from our company that have amazed us. They've been to the tomb early this morning and they said he's not there. Now, the report is...
Not just that he's not there, but that they've seen angels that said he was alive.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's going on here? And certain of them that were with us went to the tomb and found it. So, but they saw him not. Now, we've got the setting before us and the history of the events taking place. Verse 25, and he said unto them, O foolish men, this rebuke, O foolish men. Is Jesus calling them fools? Well, before we want to go that far, we simply want to note that the evidence is overwhelming. We have on the board just a few of the prophecies. Now, they've mentioned something concerning the prophets, that Jesus was a prophet, mighty in word and deed. And these are the things that Jesus had taught. Oh, slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken. Now, I want to note just here what the prophets had spoken in just a few of these. Psalm 2, we've just studied that. What is it that Psalm 2 helps us to understand about who Jesus is?
The Son of God.
He's the Son of God. Now, we could just let that stand. Psalm 2, the Son of God. He's the Son of God. Psalm 16, what would be just a brief statement characterizing Psalm 16? What did David do in Psalm 16? What did he prophesy? Jesus would be raised from the dead. That's right. Psalm 110, we just talked about that in our Hebrew study, and we've just talked about it in Psalms study. Psalm 110, what's the point of Psalm 110?
Jesus,
priest after the order of Melchizedek, sitting on the right hand of God. That's right. And Isaiah 53, any of us know what Isaiah 53 is about. It's the suffering servant, details about how he would die and so forth. And here's just four psalms. Well, three psalms in Isaiah, four prophecies. But we know there was a whole lot more than four. And what had Jesus been preaching during this time? What had he performed miracles to confirm? What was the point of all of that? Confirm that he is the Christ, the Messiah, the one that these Old Testament prophets had pointed to. Now, when we look at all of these prophecies, would it seem then that they should understand that these prophecies are identifying who Jesus is? And indeed, on the third day, he would be raised from the dead. That's what he preached. That's what they've understood him to be saying. So why the rebuke, O foolish man, and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken?
Well, they had eyes to see and they couldn't see, and they had ears to hear and they couldn't hear. And even in Acts, the first chapter, so they ask him in verse 6, Lord, dost thou at this time restore the kingdom of Israel? So even that time, many days later, they still didn't understand. They were slow of heart. And that's why he calls them foolish, is because they could read all that, and they had read all that, and they'd known it all their lives, but they still had a preconception that Jesus would remove Rome from them and set up a kingdom in physical Jerusalem to rule the earth, as it were.
When we look at passages like John 5 and John 6, John 10, and we use the expression of Jesus banging his head against the wall, the frustration of he's performed a miracle and fed all these thousands of people, and then they the next day say, why don't you perform a miracle? Or John 10, tell us plainly whether or not you're the Christ. And we look at statements like that and we become so frustrated. I do. Can you imagine how Jesus must have felt? The evidence is so overwhelming, and why isn't it accepted? And now here, among the disciples, these men are among the disciples, and they're familiar with all these prophecies, and they still not wrap their minds around it. Still haven't got it. Now, I want you to look at verse 26 and 7 specifically. He asked them, behooved it not the Christ, that is the Messiah, to suffer these things and to enter into his glory? And beginning from Moses and from all the prophets, he interpreted. Randy, when you read that, that wasn't the word from the New American Standard.
He explained.
Okay, he explained the scriptures, these things concerning himself. I would like to suggest to you that sometimes we read a statement like that and we say, well, he just told them. But now let me rephrase it. How much time would it take you if you're trying to show somebody that might be familiar with Psalm 2 and Psalm 16 and Psalm 110 and Isaiah 53, just these four passages? How much time would it take you?
It's taken us months in our class.
Well, he explained to them the scriptures. Here's just four. How long would it take you to explain these four? I would suggest to you that Jesus was with them for quite a little while, and they invited him to spend the night. And he's explaining to them the scriptures. Another interesting note that I find as I read this is in verse 31, it says, their eyes were opened, and they knew him, and he vanished out of their sight. Now, don't ask me to explain how he vanished out of their sight. It's an irrelevant point to try to explain it, but to understand that that's what he did. The thing that I want us to emphasize here is their eyes were opened. How were their eyes opened?
By words.
By words. He's explaining the scriptures to them. Any of you ever have your eyes opened when somebody's explaining the scriptures to you? He did. And I suggest to you that that's exactly what took place over here in Luke 24. We noticed in verse 26 a few moments ago, he explained these things. But dropping down in that text to verse 44, we've got a more specific instance with the apostles. And he said unto them, these are my words which I spake to you while I was yet with you, that all things must needs be fulfilled, which are written in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms concerning me. Wasn't that just exactly what he said in verse 27 to these men?
We talked about how the disciples, the apostles, were thinking of the earthly context in which they lived, the Roman occupation. And by explaining, like by going way back, he gives them the full context. Let me give you the big picture.
Kind of like the timeline, isn't it?
Where this fits into the, you know, not just these few years, you know, of occupation, but the whole history. And the fact that he is breaking bread and blessing it. It's a meal. It's not the Lord's Supper, but somehow that was the moment right after which it...
Kind of a light bulb moment. Really, yeah. Their eyes were open and they knew him. And he vanished out of their sight. So he's explaining these things to them, as he did to the apostles. The scriptures were open. The apostles' understanding was open. It would take longer for some than for others. Is that the case when we're studying with somebody?
The trip to Emmaus, it's 7 miles from Jerusalem.
Yep.
It takes a while to walk for 7 miles.
It does. Some longer than others.
Especially if you're not going at a pretty good clip. I mean, if you're standing, if you're talking along the way. And the same thing with the apostles there in verse 44 and 45. He was with the apostles for 40 days before he ascended. And this passage here in the end of Luke 24 is just before the ascension.
Yeah.
But it doesn't say how long just before the ascension.
No, it does not.
He may have been explaining or opening their minds to understand the scriptures for a long time.
Yeah. Richard?
No, I would contend that verse 31 has nothing to do with the teaching. It has to do with the fact that now he is recognized physically to them. It doesn't have anything to do with the teaching that he gave. That was talked about earlier, and it's also talked about later when they describe their situation. But the opening of the eyes was simply, oh, now Jesus made his presence known to them as to who he was.
Perhaps that's so. I would say perhaps that's so. Well, all right. I won't argue with you, but I perhaps that's so. That's my opinion of it. I wouldn't contend that that's necessarily the case, but any more so than I would here. Look at Luke 24. You don't see the same thing in Luke 24, 44. These are my words which I spake unto you while I was with you, that all things must needs be fulfilled, which are written in the law of Moses and the prophets and Psalms concerning me. Then opened he their mind that they might understand the scriptures. Does he not identify himself to them as the one who fulfilled these Old Testament prophets, just like he did to these fellows?
It said that he appeared to them in a different form.
Yes, that's true.
He has opened their eyes so that he's no longer in the other form.
Agreed.
That's all they're talking about.
Okay, agreed.
Go ahead, Jane.
That was going to be my point. When we look at it in the ESV, I haven't made the comparison between the ESV and the ASV. But when we look at Luke 24:16, it says their eyes were kept from recognizing him.
Yeah.
And so then when they get to this point, yes, he's explained all of the scriptures and how that ties back to him. But up until now, they have still not been permitted to recognize him.
Right, physically. Yeah, physically. Agreed. I wouldn't argue the point. But it's a whole lot more than just a physical recognition, is it not, that he's declaring to them in this text?
No.
Well, now that I would disagree with.
The passage is leading up to that. They want him to stay. I mean, it says that they urge him to stay with them. And then at the meal, I mean, they mention it in verse 30, and then
35.
In 35, they began to relate, like, to the others, their experiences on the road, and how he was recognized by them in the breaking of the bread. I mean, what a moment that must have been for that literal recognition of who he was, not just the understanding of what had happened, but, oh, whoa, it's Jesus right here.
Yeah, Jesus who? The Christ, the Messiah. Right?
I think 35 kind of clears it up. Verse 35, they're explaining when they recognized him.
Yeah.
Was when he broke bread, and that's in verse 30 and 31. In 31, then their eyes were opened. I think that is making reference to they recognized him. Their eyes were opened. They recognized him. I don't think their eyes were opened means that they understood what he was explaining in verse 27. I think we can assume that when he explained it to them in verse 27, they understood.
Sure. Well, and in verse 32 it says,
weren't our hearts burning when he was explaining?
Yeah, yeah. That? Something we're catching on to, yeah. Go ahead.
So, as they're walking along, he is, just to use a phrase, he's Fred the Gardener. And now, when he breaks the bread, he's Jesus of Nazareth. That's the only difference between the two. Now, yes, the overall context is, yes, he explained the scriptures and who he was, who Jesus was to them, but it wasn't until verse 31 that he was no longer Fred the Gardener, but now he was Jesus of Nazareth.
Okay.
That's the only thing that...
I guess, Richard, the thing that I'm seeing different here is that, yes, they recognize him as Jesus of Nazareth, but he's just expounded the scriptures to them as to who Jesus of Nazareth is.
I'm not saying that he hasn't.
Well, my point is, I don't want us to just see this simply nothing other than just, well, I don't know who this man is, and now I know it's Jesus. Who is Jesus? What's he just told them about who Jesus is?
That's what the rest of the context is all about.
That's right. That's what I'm trying to say.
But this verse 31,
okay. All right.
Is saying
right.
It's Jesus of Nazareth.
Okay, all right. So I just don't want to come away from this with that's all they've got. They know it's Jesus of Nazareth now. No, this whole thing is to identify who Jesus of Nazareth is. He's the one that's fulfilled these Old Testament scriptures. He is the Christ, the Messiah. And if that's not the point, then I'm not sure I know what it is. It's not just to identify him as a man, but it's to identify him as the Messiah.
Well, no, if I was to understand that this was just to identify him as a man, I would have to rip that verse out of context.
Yeah.
But we don't.
I think verse 31, their eyes were opened, means they recognized him as being Jesus instead of the gardener.
Yeah, agreed.
But in verse 45, it's the profound statement that you just made.
Yeah.
In verse 45, he opened their minds. Mm-hmm. Now, through explaining what the scriptures say, they understand that this is not just Jesus of Nazareth, but the Son of God,
yes,
the Savior of mankind.
But keep in mind, we've got two separate circumstances here.
Yeah.
They're different occasions. In verse 26 and 27, he's talking to two men.
Yeah.
And in verse 45, he's talking to the 44 and following, he's talking to the apostles.
He's talking to the apostles plus a bunch of other people.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah. So we've got all of this. We've got two settings here, the men of Emmaus and the apostles in particular here.
In verse 21, they still, but we were hoping it was him who would redeem Israel, but they're still on the earthly version of what they think is supposed to be happening. But in 32, right after they see him for who he, in 31, they see that it's Jesus, and then he vanishes, and they say, were not our hearts burning within us while he was speaking to us? They were building that,
yeah,
understanding. You can kind of picture them going, the pieces are coming together.
And you've got the same thing in verses 44 and 45.
Yes.
It's coming together. They're understanding. And what a profound thing. I think this is just absolutely profound. Because the very thing that Jesus has been telling the disciples all prior to this, he's Jesus of Nazareth, that's right. But who is Jesus of Nazareth? And you'll note that this is the substance of Peter's sermon in Acts 2. He starts with Jesus of Nazareth. And then here's what David said about the Messiah. And then what's the conclusion to his sermon? Who is Jesus of Nazareth? Well, God has raised him from the dead and made him both Lord and Christ. He's the Messiah. And so I think this is a profound context as a whole that we need to utilize. Anyway, enough on that. We'll mark that and come back to that.